Chapter 9. The Neurology of Free Will. Are we responsible for our habits? 1. The morning the trouble began, years before she realized there was even trouble in the first place, Angie Bachman was sitting at home staring at the television, so bored that she was giving serious thought to reorganizing the silverware drawer. Her youngest daughter had started kindergarten a few weeks earlier, and her two older daughters were in middle school, their lives filled with friends and activities and gossip their mother couldn't possibly understand. Her husband, a land surveyor, often left for work at 8 and didn't get home until 6. The house was empty except for Bachman. It was the first time in almost 2 decades since she had gotten married at 19 and pregnant by 20, and her days had become crowded with packing school lunches, playing princess, and basically running a family car shuttle service, that she felt genuinely alone. In high school, her friends told her she should become a model. She had been that pretty. But when she dropped out and then married a guitar player who eventually got a real job, she settled on being a mom instead. Now it was 10:30 in the morning. Her 3 daughters were gone, and Bachman had resorted, again, to taping a piece of paper over the kitchen clock to stop herself from looking at it every 3 minutes. She had no idea what to do next. That day, she made a deal with herself. If she could make it until noon without going crazy or eating the cake in the fridge, she would leave the house and do something fun. She spent the next 90 minutes trying to figure out what exactly that would be. When the clock hit 12 o'clock, she put on some makeup and a nice dress and drove to a riverboat casino about 20 minutes away from her house. Even at noon on a Thursday, the casino was filled with people doing things besides watching soap operas and folding the laundry. There was a band playing near the entrance. A woman was handing out free cocktails. Bachman ate shrimp from a buffet. The whole experience felt luxurious, like playing hooky. She made her way to a blackjack table where a dealer patiently explained the rules. When her $40 of chips were gone, she glanced at her watch and saw 2 hours had flown by, and she needed to hurry home to pick up her youngest daughter. That night at dinner, for the first time in a month, she had something to talk about besides outguessing a contestant on The Price is Right. Angie Bachman's father was a truck driver who had remade himself midlife into a semi-famous songwriter. Her brother had become a songwriter too and had won awards. Bachman, on the other hand, was often introduced by her parents as the one who became a mom. "I always felt like the untalented one," she told me. "I think I'm smart. And I know I was a good mom. But there wasn't a lot I could point to and say, that's why I'm special." After that first trip to the casino, Bachman started going to the riverboat once a week on Friday afternoons. It was a reward for making it through empty days, keeping the house clean, staying sane. She knew gambling could lead to trouble, so she set strict rules for herself. No more than 1 hour at the blackjack table per trip, and she only gambled what was in her wallet. "I considered it kind of like a job," she told me. "I never left the house before noon, and I was always home in time to pick up my daughter. I was very disciplined." And she got good. At first, she could hardly make her money last an hour. Within 6 months, however, she had picked up enough tricks that she adjusted her rules to allow for 2 or 3 hour shifts, and she would still have cash in her pocket when she walked away. One afternoon, she sat down at the blackjack table with $80 in her purse and left with $530, enough to buy groceries, pay the phone bill, and put a bid in the rainy day fund. By then, the company that owned the casino, Harrah's Entertainment, was sending her coupons for free buffets. She would treat the family to dinner on Saturday nights. The state where Bachman was gambling, Iowa, had legalized gambling only a few years earlier. Prior to 1989, The state's lawmakers worried that the temptations of cards and dice might be difficult for some citizens to resist. It was a concern as old as the nation itself. Gambling is the child of avarice, the brother of iniquity, and the father of mischief, George Washington wrote in 1783. This is a vice which is productive of every possible evil. In a word, few gain by this abominable practice, while thousands are injured. Protecting people from their bad habits, in fact, defining which habits should be considered bad in the first place, is a prerogative lawmakers have eagerly seized. Prostitution, gambling, liquor sales on the Sabbath, pornography, usurious loans, sexual relations outside of marriage, or if your tastes are unusual, within marriage, are all habits that various legislatures have regulated, outlawed, or tried to discourage with strict and often ineffective laws. When Iowa legalized casinos, lawmakers were sufficiently concerned that they limited the activity to riverboats and mandated that no one could wager more than $5 per bet, with a maximum loss of $200 per person per cruise. Within a few years, however, after some of the state's casinos moved to Mississippi, where no limit gaming was allowed, the Iowa legislature lifted those restrictions. In 2010, the state's coffers swelled by more than $269 million from taxes on gambling.